Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news.
We'll begin with the contrast between the international condemnation of Turkey's invasion of northern Syria and the enormous popularity Erdogan has at home, with even opposition parties heaping praise on the military operation as jingoism and patriotism consumes the media, just as it did here when the US invaded Iraq with shock and awe. Graham Fuller, a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and the author of Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, joins us to discuss his latest article at grahamefuller.com, Everybody Betraying Everybody in Syria, and to criticize what he considers superficial and over-the-top headlines in the media's coverage of what is happening in northern Syria. We will examine the role of Russia and the extent to which Putin, unlike his American counterpart, practices diplomacy and has good relations with all players in the Middle East: Israel, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iran, Turkey, Cyprus, Lebanon, Qatar, the UAE, and Yemen. And following a stinging rebuke from Congress yesterday with a House resolution vote of 354-60 condemning Trump's betrayal of the Kurds, we'll assess whether the interventionists in Washington who argue the U.S. must maintain its credibility and leadership in the region actually means U.S. hegemony, which, with or without Trump, is on the wane. Then we'll speak with Vladimir van Wildenberg, a journalist and political analyst specializing in issues concerning Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey, with a particular focus on Kurdish politics, who has covered several major battles between ISIS in northern Syria and Iraqi Kurdistan, and is the author of The Kurds of Northern Syria, Governance, Diversity, and Conflicts. He joins us to discuss the just-announced ceasefire deal between the U.S. and Turkey, which leaves Turkey with a 12-mile buffer zone inside of Syria. Then finally, we'll speak with Susan Rice, who was National Security Advisor to President Obama and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, and is the author of a new book just out, Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. She joins us to discuss the chaos and disarray at the top of our national security and foreign policy structure as Trump insults Speaker Pelosi and his former Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, as well as her own experience under fire from post-truth Republicans cynically advancing their Benghazi conspiracy in the absence of facts and evidence. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Bear, a novel of eco-violence in the Canadian Northwest. And his latest article at grahamefuller.com is Everybody Betraying Everybody in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
So let's start with Erdogan's motives in this invasion, war, whatever you want to call it, in the north of Syria, which was precipitated by a phone call between Erdogan and Trump on the 6th, I think, on Sunday night, and it was announced on the 7th. But my understanding is that there may well be a domestic political component here, because Erdogan has been losing a couple of elections, and this has been incredibly good for his political fortunes. He could not be riding more high. And, of course, we recall back when we had shock and awe when George W. Bush invaded Iraq, the press went crazy, the country was nationalistic and jingoistic. So it's not as if it doesn't happen here. But, for example, the front page of the opposition news, the main opposition newspaper in Turkey today, says Americans, Europeans, Chinese, Arabs, all united against Turkey, bring it on. And the guy that just won, beat Erdogan in Istanbul, he's now all in with the operation against the Kurds, even though he's in coalition with the Kurdish parties.
Yeah, well, I think you put your finger on it accurately, in the sense that anytime there's domestic trouble in Turkey, most of the leaders will play the nationalist card, and Erdogan is very skilled at this. It's important to remember, though, that Erdogan actually in his first 10 years, I think has been, I've often said this, one of the most remarkable prime ministers that Turkey ever had, and probably went further than any prime minister ever did in Turkish history towards acknowledging the existence of a Kurdish reality, acknowledging that there were identity issues that needed to be dealt with, and got into some fairly serious negotiations. Those fell through for complex reasons on both sides, and then when Erdogan began to feel under political pressure for other reasons, he went for the nationalist card and lined himself up with a very right-wing Turkish nationalist party. But it's a reliable issue for Turks to stir up Turks, especially if you've got the foreign world against you. I mean, that's money in the bank for Erdogan. But I think it does get at a deeper issue. It's not just transient daily politics or even immediate electoral politics. The question of who is a Turk and are Kurds part of being a Turk or not. The identity of Turks for a long time was simply if you lived in Turkey, you were a Turk, period. And, you know, nobody quibbled about whether you were Jewish or Greek or Albanian or Kurdish origin. You were all Turks together. Not a bad idea, but in the end, I think the Kurds felt they had their identity had been crushed, and identity politics did come in, but it's a long-standing issue about how to define what is a Kurd, how loyal are you to Turkey, all those things.
Well, what is it, though, about the Kurds that upsets the Turks, not to mention maybe the Iraqis and also the Iranians to some extent, and the Syrians? I mean, they've been occupying the best land, the most fertile agricultural land, the oil fields, etc. And now, of course, as a result of this invasion, the Kurds have lost all their leverage with Assad. They've just had to go hat in hand to have him rescue them along with the Russians. But what's the animus about? Because Öcalan, the head of the PKK, they've had him in custody for the longest time.
Yes, and I think Öcalan, who certainly the PKK that you just referred to has been a terrorist organization. More accurately, it's been a guerrilla organization, essentially fighting and using guerrilla means to try to gain some degree of independence in the past. But you're right, since he's been in jail, I think he's now been trying to work for a genuine political settlement. I think one of the reasons he hasn't been executed is because the Turks see him as a valuable interlocutor when the time comes that there is going to be a more significant deal. Öcalan has a lot of clout still among many Kurds. But, I mean, it's a complex issue, and as I pointed out in my piece, you've got Kurds living in four different countries of the world. I mean, this is one of the biggest peoples in the world that don't have their own state, the Kurds. But they live in Turkey, the biggest group. They live in Iran. They live in Iraq. And they live in Syria. And so they've been acculturated, socialized into Arab culture, Persian culture, and Turkish culture, and speak, Turkish or Arabic or Persian along with their own native Kurdish. So they're really divided, even psychologically and sociologically divided group, but it's hard for them to pull it all together over the years.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and his latest book is Bear, a novel of eco-violence in the Canadian Northwest. And his latest article at GrahamEFuller.com is Everybody Betraying Everybody in Syria. So you don't buy a lot of what's going on in the mainstream media, Graham. You're saying in your article, the bottom line of the story is that after some 8 years of civil conflict, the situation in Syria is basically reverting to the pre-conflict norm. The Syrian government is now close to reestablishing its sovereign control over the entire country. So what's your sense then of, well, describe what you think is the hyperbole going on in our political debate at the moment?
Well, obviously, a great deal of it has to do with domestic American politics. There are those large elements, actually, in the country who will oppose anything that Trump does, regardless of what it is, simply because their number one agenda is getting rid of Trump. That's understandable, but I think not very intelligent approach to things. And then there are those probably more important and maybe more dangerous in the end who essentially support the idea of the American empire and want to maintain American military presence all over the world, maintain high military expenditures in this whole process, do not want any other country to be a regional hegemon. Therefore, the idea that the U.S. would be deciding that the Syrian war is no longer worth the candle, at least for the United States, and pulling out is anathema to these people. They don't want to pull out of anywhere at any time. It's just we got to do it better, and that I think is what has made it so dangerous from the American point of view. We're not analyzing the issues as they stand. We're simply taking the position that we should not retreat or lose credibility, as the expression goes.
Well, short of getting into a discussion about whether or not the Republic will survive the empire, it does seem that there is a retreat underway, whether or not it's precipitated by Donald Trump or not. And it's hard to believe that 1,000 troops in Syria is the number one priority in getting out of endless wars when we have soldiers, the military deployed in about 186 countries. But the irony that I see in this current situation is that in spite of the fact that Iran is under crippling sanctions and the United States has essentially declared economic warfare on them, they are geopolitically, they're doing incredibly well. They have influence over major Arab capitals, Baghdad, Damascus, Beirut, Sana'a, and it looks as though Vladimir Putin was just in Saudi Arabia yesterday. He was greeted with a very royal, lavish reception. He's brokering a deal that the Saudis now are going hat in hand to the Iranians. The Emiratis have already done that. So for all of Pompeo and Bolton and Netanyahu's bluster about organizing an alliance against Iran, that's crumbling before our eyes. And by the way, Trump just sent several thousand troops into Saudi Arabia, so you wonder why he's putting troops in Saudi Arabia and pulling them out of Syria.
Well, I think that's just for demonstration purposes to show that, hey, guys, we haven't completely abandoned you, and, hey, we're not pulling out of the region entirely, so we're sending them to Saudi Arabia. I don't think that is at all meaningful in any military sense. But we are our own worst enemies in many respects in diplomacy in the Middle East. For one thing, we don't have much diplomacy. It's essentially our diplomacy has been turned over years ago. This is not Trump. It's years and years going back to the military. And secondly, I think Putin has wisely, as most other world leaders has maintained, he talks with everybody. He negotiates with everybody. He negotiates with people who hate each other's guts. He's very close to Netanyahu. Netanyahu has been dozens of times, literally, to Russia visiting with Putin, yet he's supposed to be our closest ally. He talks to the Israelis, then he talks to the Iranians deeply. He talks to the Saudis. He talks to the Turks. He talks to the Yemenis, he talks to the Lebanese. Not surprisingly, he does have some diplomatic clout. Whereas the United States is taking this kind of head in the sand approach, of saying that we will never talk to, or we don't want to talk to the Iranians. Now maybe Trump is loosening up on that, but basically we refuse to talk to them. We can't talk to any of the major Islamic organizations in the Middle East. I'm not talking terrorists. I'm talking just things like the Muslim Brotherhood. We can't talk to Iran, and we can't talk to Hamas, which is a major player. We have trouble in talking to Turkey. It just doesn't need to be quite this painful, in my view. We haven't even been able to talk to the Syrians for most of the time because we were still hoping against hope that we could knock this guy off. Maybe there was a hope of this early on when the uprising began against Assad in 2011. But it became fairly clear that he was not going to fall very easily. But the U.S. has just been throwing good money after bad to try to dump him and supporting the worst of allies, including al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, anybody that could help overthrow Assad, and nobody thinking very much about who will come once Assad is gone. Well, you know, a lot of Syrians have thought about this. It's not many people hate Assad, but they also say, you know, we do not want war. We do not want civil war, and we do not want some jihadi bunch coming in and taking over our country once Assad goes. So that's why it's been so difficult for us to get anywhere with this program.
Well, Susan Rice is on today's program, Graham, and she was National Security Advisor when Barack Obama, of course, walked away from the red line. But going back to the current situation, is it feasible that Erdogan is using his leverage against Europe, for example? Europeans are cutting off arms sales, etc. He's threatening, you know, to dump 3.6 million Syrian refugees on Europe. And last time that happened, it has really changed the politics of Europe, leading to a lot of right-wing parties taking over, leading to Brexit, leading to the Scandinavians, normally very socially democratic people, now getting right-wing parties surging in Scandinavia, in Germany, in Italy, of course Poland and Hungary have turned far to the right, etc. So he's using that leverage, and I assume that basically he's saying, look, if you know guys don't go along with what I'm trying to do with my southern border, then I can do this to you. Is it feasible, though, to resettle those Arab refugees as a buffer along that border, displace the Kurds who've been living there for, you know, God knows how long? These people, that the refugees that are replacing the Kurdish farmers in this fertile part of Syria, are basically city folk from Damascus, etc. So does any of it make any sense? Is this a political sideshow for Erdogan, or is there actually a workable policy here, you know, as much as a lot of people object to it?
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag, Ian. For one thing, yes, the Kurds are in that area, but it is not exclusively a Kurdish area. It's lots and lots of Arabs in across much of that belt as well. Secondly, I think it is very realistic from the Turkish point of view that a lot of these 3 million plus refugees from Syria who are now in Turkey can go back to Turkey, but I don't think they can go back to Syria, to their homeland. But I don't think they're going to want to live in, as you pointed out, in agricultural lands. There may be essentially more mercantile people who will want to go back to the capital once this country will calm down, and I think it will calm down. So we don't have to have a buffer there once the conflict has died, once the conflict has been settled. So I think to continue to talking about a buffer is not meaningful. The term buffer really came up mostly as part of a broader device to help chop Syria up into pieces, which is often the favorite method of external powers that want to divide and conquer. But so I think it's probable that a lot of Syrians will go back to Syria and to where they came from under those better conditions, and we do not need the buffer. And the Kurds, sadly, will not be able to have their autonomous region particularly, but they will integrate back into the Syrian state, probably with some privileges on, cultural autonomy and things like that down the road. But it's not like a buffer is a requirement.
But the one issue that disturbs a lot of people and I think is responsible for the huge vote in the resolution in the House yesterday, which Republicans joined in 2-1 with the Democrats, which is apparently what really got under Trump's skin yesterday in the meeting in the cabinet room where he insulted Nancy Pelosi and they got into a back and forth and she stormed out and had a press conference afterwards saying that she's concerned about Trump's health and we should pray for his health, which I guess you could insert the word mental health in there because she said he had a complete meltdown. But the issue that bothers, I think, the Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill is they talk about the sellout of the Kurds. I don't think anybody much in the country, particularly Trump supporters, even know who they are and don't care. And Trump is putting out that kind of line that they never helped us in World War II. They weren't at Normandy. They only fight for money. They're not angels. They're a bunch of communists. And the reason that the Democrats like them is that they're a bunch of communists. So that's the kind of stuff that we're getting from him. But the ISIS issue, whether these prisoners are released, whether we snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory, that really bothers people. How do you see that? Because my understanding is if the Syrians take over these prisons, these ISIS fighters, and maybe they may not ever see the light of day again.
Well, that's correct. First of all, I think it's a mistake. I have great admiration for the Kurds. Let me start out saying that. I think they've had a bad deal from all countries in the world for many, many, many years, and I hope somehow they will manage to get their act and get a better situation in the Middle East. And they have fought, helped the United States fight against ISIS, the Islamic Caliphate, in the region. But it's not like the Kurds are the only group that have opposed ISIS. Most of the forces, Russia hates and fears ISIS. Iraq has been fighting against ISIS all along. Syria has been fighting against ISIS all along. Turkey basically hates ISIS too, although they played little games here and there when it was tactically useful. Iran hates ISIS. So Hezbollah hates ISIS. Saudis hate ISIS. So, I mean, the idea that there have to be this small contingent of American troops there working with Kurds to keep the situation under control seems to me fairly absurd. I would, if I were the people, the ISIS prisoners in that area, I would be very fearful for my life indeed once Syria takes over fully or with Iraqi support or anybody else coming into the region. Very hardly a soul supports ISIS, and most of them want to kill them.
Well, just in closing, Graham Fuller, how do you see, regardless of our politics, just focusing back on Turkey and how much this is a big win domestically for Erdogan, as Pence and Pompeo talk to him, if we get punitive, as the Europeans are, what happens with NATO? Is there a point where there's no protocol in NATO to kick a member state out? But at this point, it just seems like this whole thing could backfire. You know, there's the issue of 50 hydrogen bombs sitting at Incirlik, which some people are concerned about. But in general, are we likely to make things worse between the U.S. and Turkey? And the letter that Trump wrote to Erdogan was ridiculous. I mean, don't be a tough guy. Don't be a tough guy. Don't be a fool. You know what happened, of course, according to the BBC, Erdogan threw it into the trash. So yeah. I guess it's a long-winded way to say, are we going to make things worse between the U.S. and Turkey, or are we going to figure out a way to put this relationship back on track?
Turkey has been drifting in the direction of ever greater independence and ever greater insistence on its own national sovereign interests and a greater disinclination to follow U.S. policies, which in the Middle East they perceive to have been disastrous and failing. I think that assessment is relatively correct, whatever the Turks may think. So, I doubt that Turkey will choose to leave NATO because however bad their relations are with the West, Turkey wants to play on all sides. Turkey wants to be part of Asia, work with Russia, work with Iran, work with the Arabs, work with the Balkans, work with everybody, work with the Europeans, work with NATO. It's just an extra benefit, an extra card in their deck. So I doubt that the Turks would initiate some pullout like that. On the other side, I doubt very much that the Europeans are going to decide that they want to throw Turkey out. It's a very important country. They would see NATO as essentially a small instrument of leverage over Turkey. It does involve some money and things like that. So I don't think from that perspective it's going to happen either. But finally, there are many people, including myself, who really feel that NATO has outlived its benefit anyway, which was important during the Cold War. But since the Cold War, has mainly been an instrument for the United States to maintain some kind of policy control over European foreign policies. And Europeans are increasingly feel that's less important. So I don't think Turkey will leave NATO. I don't think NATO is going to throw them out. But it's going to be, I think there's going to be very, very prickly relations with Turkey permanently, absolutely permanently, as it attempts to go its own way and to be a major regional power in its own right, dealing with everybody.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former Vice Chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who's currently a Professor of History at Simon Fraser University. He's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Bear, a novel of eco-violence in the Canadian Northwest. And his latest article at GrahamEFuller.com is Everybody Betraying Everybody in Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from the Netherlands is Vladimir van Wilgenberg, a journalist and political analyst specializing in issues concerning Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey, with a particular focus on Kurdish politics. He has covered several major battles against ISIS in northern Syria and Iraqi Kurdistan for outlets such as the Middle East Eye, The Daily Beast, The Region, Defense Post, Al Jazeera, and Foreign Policy. And his latest book, based on first-hand research and interviews conducted on the ground in Iraqi Kurdistan and northern Syria, is The Kurds of Northern Syria, Governance, Diversity, and Conflicts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vladimir van Wilgenberg.
Thank you.
And what's your sense or understanding now the fate of the Kurdish fighters who the U.S. abandoned, or at least President Trump abandoned? They've had to make a very hasty deal with Syria, with the Assad regime, although they've been in
communication with them for some time. Have they lost all of their leverage in effect in making this deal?
Well, it's very difficult to say now because they're saying that the deal is only to protect the border and that their administration will stay somehow intact. So it's difficult to say. And also there is this issue that you have this new announcement recently by the U.S. administration after a meeting with Turkish officials about like a ceasefire agreement. There were some people saying this is the end of the Syrian Kurds, but I think the game, it's not being played out, and we still have to see the next few days what's going to exactly happen.
But Erdogan has refused a ceasefire. So what has he agreed to?
Well, according to the U.S. administration, there was a ceasefire agreement that the Kurds should withdraw from a 12-mile zone from the border from northern Syria. And then Turkey stops their operation. And then if this works, then the U.S. administration will not put sanctions on Turkey. But it's very fresh. I mean, it just happened, the announcement. So we have to wait. This also the reaction of the Kurds, let's say, of the military leadership of the Kurds, because until now it's just happened. And I mean, all these days has been like this. Every day something else is being said or tweeted or responded to. So we have to see.
Sure, but do we have any idea of how long this 12-mile buffer will go along that lengthy border between Turkey and Syria?
Well, I think we have to wait until there's more clarification from U.S. Administration officials. But it seems that they are talking about the area between Tal Abyad and Ras Al Ain, where most of the fighting is taking place. Even now, there was reportedly a hospital shelled in Ras Al Ain, so I think they're still fighting. So we have to see how that works out. And even if the Kurds will accept being removed from that area, because in the past they said, like, also we had the security mechanism deal and we removed our fortifications and some of our forces, and then still Turkey attacked. So, of course, there's also a trust issue. Like, do they still trust the U.S. after what happened? I mean, it's not for nothing that they basically reached a deal with the Syrian government to come to these cities. That's not for nothing.
Sure. And what role has Russia played in this? Have they brokered this, or is this between Turkey and the United States?
Well, this specific deal between the U.S. and Turkey is between the U.S. and Turkey. But the deal between the Syrian government and the Kurds, most likely Russia played a role in that. But that's not, we haven't seen any public confirmation of that by the Russian government. But most likely they were part of this deal between the Syrian Kurds and Damascus, because they have been calling for a deal between the Kurds and Damascus for a long time now. But this new deal between U.S. and Turkey, we still have to see how that will play out.
But the idea, or the whatever Erdogan, I mean, obviously this thing has been very good for Erdogan's domestic popularity. He'd lost a couple of elections, and now even the opposition praising the military actions in northern Syria. But the idea of resettling the 3.6 million Arab refugees from the Syrian war into this buffer zone has always been rather dubious, has it not? Because these are urban refugees mostly, and the area is Kurdish and Arab farmers. So if this 12-mile deal ends up being the new status quo, is it going to fulfill Erdogan's ambitions to resettle and have that buffer along the border?
Well, I'm not sure if this small area is big enough for 3.6 million people, and also the majority of those people are not from Tal Abyad or that area. I mean, there were some people that fled Tal Abyad from the fighting when the Kurds took it from ISIS, so it's possible to bring those people back to Tal Abyad. But I think most of the population of Serekania or Ras Al Ain, they were still living there. So I think it will not fulfill the ambitions of Erdogan. And even if, let's say, if Turkey does get what it wanted, this is 30 miles border zone, then even then it would be very difficult to implement, because the majority of those people living in Turkey, they are not from that area. They're mostly from Aleppo and like other cities in northwestern Syria. There's like a very small part of them that are actually from the northeast of Syria or from this border in northern Syria. So you would get like demographic change. I mean, there's a lot of Arabs also living in that area. But for instance, the remaining Kurds, if they will be basically displaced and then replaced with Arabs, then it would be like only almost completely Arab majority area, like the whole border. And now you still have like areas like cities with a Kurdish majority. But if Erdogan's plan will be completely implemented, then you will basically have all those Kurdish majority small towns and cities. They would be like Arabized if Erdogan gets what he wants. But it seems that there's something else going on now, and we have to see how this will play out in the end.
And again, I'm speaking with Vladimir van Wilgenberg, a journalist and political analyst specializing in issues concerning Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey, with a particular focus on Kurdish politics. He's the author of The Kurds of Northern Syria, Governance, Diversity, and Conflicts. And what is the situation vis-a-vis ISIS? That's obviously the idea that ISIS prisoners would be released. And I understand that the shock troops that Erdogan's been using, the so-called Free Syrian Army, have a lot of jihadis in their ranks, and some of them have been releasing prisoners as far as we know. But if the Syrians take over these camps, I don't think the fate of those prisoners would be particularly good. What's the latest on that? That is really, I think, what's driven the vote in the House here in Washington yesterday, which was a heavy condemnation of Trump, with 2-1 Republicans joining with the Democrats in a resolution against what Trump has done. I think, by and large, the Congress people were probably motivated by that fear of ISIS being given a get-out-of-jail-free pass. What's your understanding, since you're very familiar with that area, Vladimir? What is going on, and how many of these prisoners have been freed?
Well, until now, there have been 5 prisoners freed from a prison in the city of Qamishli. There was also a camp, a refugee or IDP camp, that was shelled, and the administration had to evacuate the refugee camp. So I think a lot of the ISIS families, they escaped from this specific camp. And then there was also a prison in the city of Ayn Issa where most likely some people were escaped. But it's still not clear yet. Like the Belgians now saying that at least two persons were escaped. That's confirmed, like 2 Belgian ISIS male fighters. But of course, we're not just talking about foreigners. We're also talking about Syrian ISIS fighters that could escape. But so far, it seems that a large number of ISIS families have escaped from the camp in Ayn Issa, and like a small number of ISIS fighters in the city of Qamishli.
And have the Syrians taken over the camps in the south holding ISIS prisoners and their families?
No, until now it's still under Kurdish control. But also ISIS, there's like some online, like just before the attack, ISIS carried out an attack on Kurdish-led forces, saying this is a revenge for the woman. So there seems to be some indications that ISIS is stepping up attacks. And I think that ISIS also wants to basically free those prisoners. And there was even a statement, I think, today from ISIS that they claim to have freed some woman from a prison in Raqqa, but the local authorities in Raqqa, they deny this. But it's clear that this is like a huge risk if Turkey would be allowed to continue this operation. But the situation now also has changed because also the Syrian government has stepped in. But, I mean, they haven't taken over any prisoners. So far, they have arrived mostly in border cities to basically stop the Turks from advancing further.
So what are the Americans doing? The Russian media is crowing over the U.S. abandoning their facilities there, and they're showing pictures of refrigerators full of soda, etc. I mean, if there's a deal going on between the U.S. and Turkey, is the withdrawal of U.S. forces being halted? Is it being reversed? Or are they still getting out of there? And also, one of their big headquarters, which was also a warehouse storing arms, the so-called cement factory, the U.S. Air Force bombed it yesterday. So what's the status on the position of the U.S. troops? Are they in retreat, or are they holding, or are they going to go back?
Well, I think most of the U.S. forces around Raqqa, Kobani, Manbij, and this specific area, they have withdrawn from these areas. But there are still some areas where there are still U.S. forces present, like, for instance, the countryside of Deir ez-Zor. So a number of U.S. forces have withdrawn from their bases, including that cement factory you mentioned. But the U.S. Army is still in some bases in other parts of Syria, like in the Hasakah province, I think, and in Deir ez-Zor. So they also, the U.S. said that they would withdraw 1,000 troops, but there's not 1,000 troops in Syria. There are more troops. And also the U.S. said for sure they're going to keep troops in Tanaf, in the Tanaf base, which is not in the northeast of Syria, that's further up, to basically stop the Iranians from advancing there. But until now, there are still some U.S. troops in Syria. So I think it's unclear. I think the Trump administration still says publicly that they want to withdraw those troops that are there. But of course, you don't withdraw troops in 1 or 2 days. It takes some time to withdraw those troops.
Well, it is obviously very confusing, and there's a lot of pushback from the Congress with that resolution. So it's hard to know. And of course, Trump showed this letter that he wrote to Erdogan on the 9th, 3 days after the phone call, in which he essentially gave Erdogan the green light, which was one of the most extraordinary undiplomatic letters any world leader has ever probably sent, I think, where he said, don't be a tough guy, don't be a fool. My understanding is that Erdogan threw that letter in the trash. So what's your understanding of the U.S.-Turkish relations, you know, given the enormous amount of nationalism and jingoism going on now in the Turkish media, which is not unlike what happened here in the United States when the Bush administration invaded Iraq with shock and awe?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say. I mean, the Turkish media is always like very nationalistic, and like they have been always seen like this conspiracies of the West to divide Turkey, because this dates back to history, basically, of the Ottoman Empire, when after the defeat of the Ottoman Empire, basically like Western powers tried to divide the Ottoman Empire in pieces and they lost a lot of land. So they still have this sort of conspiracy thinking that the West is out there to divide Turkey. In the U.S., of course, you also have a lot of anger because of Turkey buying like weapons from Russia and getting closer to Iran and Russia. But also a lot of people forget that Turkey also has good relations with Venezuela. Like, this is often ignored. And also Turkey is a very big actor in like the evasion of Iran's sanctions. So, I mean, there's a lot of factors that are into play. And then you have, of course, the U.S. policy of Donald Trump, that he wants to pull troops out of the area. But if the U.S. really does this, it will be a major blow to U.S. policy. So I understand that the U.S. doesn't want to police the whole world. But if you just pull out, like, out of nowhere and leave your allies out in the cold, then basically Russia will basically benefit from that, because you see already other countries in the region that are thinking about buying Russian weapons. So it will not be only bad for security and for the prestige of the U.S., but it will also be basically bad for the U.S. arms industry. So it's like a very complicated thing with like a lot of complicating factors, but it seems that it's a bit difficult for the U.S. president to basically go through all these geopolitical political factors that are going on right now.
Well, Vladimir Van Wilkenberg, I thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Vladimir Van Wittelgenberg, who's a journalist and political analyst specializing in issues concerning Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey, with a particular focus on Kurdish politics. He's covered several major battles against ISIS in northern Syria and Iraqi Kurdistan for outlets such as the Middle East Eye, The Daily Beast, The Region, Defense Post, Al Jazeera, and Foreign Policy. And his latest book, based on first-hand research and interviews conducted on the ground in Iraqi Kurdistan and northern Syria, is The Kurds of Northern Syria: Governance, Diversity, and Conflicts. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
And until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is one.
better than before. We expected something more. Walk away now, and you're gonna start a war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ambassador Susan Rice, who served under President Barack Obama as National Security Advisor and the U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations. She is currently a Distinguished Visiting Research Fellow at the School of International Service at American University, a non-resident Senior Fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and is a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. And her latest book just out is Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Susan Rice.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And I guess it's a difficult question to answer, and it may take the entire time we have, but what do you make of what's happening now with the National Security Council, your alma mater, I guess?
Well, it's deeply discouraging because, you know, we're four national security advisors into the Trump administration, only 2.5 years. And the decision-making process appears to have broken down almost entirely. I really can't speak to the efforts of the new National Security Advisor, Mr. O'Brien, whom I've never heard of before he took the job and not met. But up until that point, including under John Bolton, the traditional decision-making apparatus where senior policymakers at the cabinet level sit around the table in the Situation Room, which I chaired as the National Security Advisor, and wrestle with what to recommend to the president on the most consequential issues, with the benefit of intelligence, with the benefit of analysis, with the benefit of various options that have been assessed. None of that happens anymore. And to the extent that there were efforts made at adhering to a process, the President of the United States has shown no interest in the input or recommendations of his expert advisors. And that's how we ended up with the catastrophe that we now face in Syria, where the President decided unilaterally and in utter ignorance, it appears, that we should remove all of our forces from northern Syria and greenlight a brutal invasion by Turkey, which has undermined, and worse than undermined, I mean, it's torpedoed the fight against ISIS. It will likely result in thousands of ISIS prisoners receiving the equivalent of get-out-of-jail-free cards. It's benefited Putin and Assad and ISIS and Erdogan, and it's extraordinarily dangerous, and it did nothing for the United States and our national security, and it makes you wonder, as I do, you know, what was in this for President Trump? What made him sacrifice our national security in such a blatant and comprehensive way? What did he get for it?
Well, that question, at least vis-a-vis Putin, arises almost all the time. And all of the conversations that he's had with Putin have remained secret. And even the notes in the Hamburg meeting were grabbed by Trump from the translator. So this is an enduring puzzle as to whether, I mean, there's never been a situation in the United States where we have ever had to question the loyalty of our own president.
Well, absolutely, and tragically and frighteningly, that's the case now. We have in the White House somebody who has upended all of the foundations of our national security policy. He daily denigrates and destroys our alliances, whether, you know, with NATO or in Asia and informally the alliance, but practical alliance we had with the Kurds. He lifts up and lauds our adversaries and gives their lies extraordinary credence, as you just mentioned, the great example being in Helsinki, where he stood next to Putin and denigrated our intelligence community and our law enforcement, and essentially put them in the category of fake news. You know, he lies every day from the White House, and he makes these impulsive, irrational decisions that profoundly undermine our national security. That's a very scary thing. And you know, we have an impeachment inquiry underway because Trump has made it clear that he's not interested in doing the business of the president or the commander-in-chief, but the business of his personal interests with respect to Ukraine. And that, have to acknowledge merits an impeachment inquiry. But what he's just done with respect to Syria and the larger pattern that you describe of selling out the U.S. interests to our adversaries, that, if anything merits scrutiny, that does.
Well, of course, in the Constitution itself, when the articles on impeachment say treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors in that order, what's been revealed about what happened in the phone conversation with the president of Ukraine arguably has already crossed into the bribery territory. So it's an amazing situation. But given your experiences, Syria, of course, came up in the recent Democratic debate where Tulsi Gabbard talked about it being a regime change war. That was a peculiar kind of, I mean, I would argue, of course, and agree that Iraq was a regime change war because the United States actually invaded the territory and did topple Saddam. But what was she talking about there, do you think?
I can't speak for Tulsi Gabbard. Honestly, I have no idea what she's thinking about anything. I have very little respect for her foreign policy perspective, broadly.
But you were there, so you were quite traumatized by what happened under the Clinton administration with Rwanda. And there's obviously a profound difference, is there not? On the one hand, you could argue we should have done something and it would have been very cheap in terms of resources and manpower. And it wouldn't have been, we wouldn't have been, you know, in a quagmire. But contrast that with what happened with Syria.
Well, I think they're very different challenges. And one of the things that I write about in my book, Tough Love, is I explain the evolution of my thinking on humanitarian intervention, is that there's, you know, no one-size-fits-all response to these situations. They're each different. In Rwanda, the heart of the mistake that I believe the United States made was not even to consider the question at a senior level as to whether or not the United States ought to intervene to try to slow or halt the genocide or to help other countries to give them the capacity to do so or anything. It came 7 days, as some of your listeners will recall, after the last American forces were ordered out of Somalia after Black Hawk Down by Congress. And so the big mistake, as I write in the book, in my judgment, with the benefit of hindsight, on Rwanda was that neither in the administration nor in Congress nor on the editorial pages of our major newspapers was there serious consideration, debate, discussion over the question of whether we could or should do anything to stop it. That's a very different circumstance than we faced in Syria, as I also write in the book, where, you know, we had endless debates and discussions, some of them very robust and contentious, about the question of whether or not the United States should intervene in the Syrian civil war on the side of the opposition to topple Assad and intervene militarily. We intervened in other ways. We intervened in terms of assisting the opposition, you know, trying to broker a diplomatic solution, providing billions of dollars of humanitarian assistance. But when it came to the question of should the U.S. engage its own forces in the fight to topple Assad before the Russians intervened, we wrestled with that constantly. And the president, President Obama, made the decision, which I acknowledge reluctantly and painfully in the book, I actually think was ultimately the right decision when you weigh the totality of U.S. interests, that the United States should not have intervened in the war to topple Assad and do it militarily. But it came, that decision was agonizing. It came at great cost in human terms. It came in serious cost in strategic terms. But the alternative, as a practical matter, would have been to engage in another Iraq-style anti-Saddam, full-ground operation, lengthy, dangerous, costly military campaign.
So your book, Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For, Ambassador Susan Rice, deals, of course, with Benghazi, where you were pilloried by the Republicans, as was
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in those long hearings. I think they had like 9 different Benghazi investigations. And this is before Donald Trump, who obviously has a very loose relationship with the truth. But you get the feeling that already the cynical use of propaganda and media that Putin has developed under his political technologist, Surkov, has already been exported to the United States to some extent, where particularly the Republicans simply pursue kind of a jihad without any truth, without any even concern about what is true or not. They just create a mantra, Fox News beats the drum, and it almost becomes a reality. When there's no there there, but they're very successful at it. And I think that's what we're going to be witnessing next year, frankly, for almost an entire year.
Well, I think there's a lot to that. And the reality is that we're almost entering, what we see in some totalitarian societies, which is a post-truth environment. And it may well have been the case that my experience of being pilloried and branded a liar for providing what was our current best information as to what had happened in the terrorist attacks in Benghazi, and being faithful to the unclassified talking points that the intelligence community had provided to me and others. And then, a week to 10 days later, with new information, it became clear that those points were in at least one critical respect inaccurate. That's a mistake. That's not a lie. And it was nonetheless, elevated into the pantheon of, of historic misrepresentations by those who were unwilling to understand or embrace the facts. Today, we're in a sort of very different place where, remarkably, on multiple times a day, from the mouth of the President of the United States, and not to mention his senior advisors, on, from the podium, from the South Lawn, or on Sunday shows, the pace of the lies that are true lies, that are, self-evident lies, is extraordinary. Whether it's the crowd size at an inauguration or everything since, we're in a place where I worry that many people are becoming inured to distinguishing between truth and falsehood. I acknowledge in my book that what I said on those Sunday shows was wrong in a critical respect, not because I was lying, but because the information was wrong and I shared it faithfully. I'd love to see some of our current leaders, and particularly the president, acknowledge when he's wrong.
Well, that's not going to happen.
I think that's a fair bet.
Well, Ambassador Susan Rice, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It's been a privilege.
And we've been speaking with Ambassador Susan Rice, who served under President Barack Obama as National Security Advisor and a U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations. She's currently a Distinguished Visiting Research Fellow at the School of International Service at American University, a non-resident Senior Fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and is a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. And her latest book just out is Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared.